KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In the low 50s.
If the Supreme Court rejects the right to same-sex marriage, that's not going to stop states from continuing to evolve in that direction.
I wanted to create this professional platform that would attract other Latino artists to our area.
Freelancing is, as it turns out, not just a change in work, but a real change in culture.
The head of the Freelancers Union talks about the freelance culture. Today on Weekday on KUOW Seattle, I'm Steve Scheer. We're also going to hear from Rose Cano, the director of Seattle's only Latino theater company. But we start with Michael Klarman, who is a professor dealing with the issues of Supreme Court and DOMA. He's at Harvard, the author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. The Supreme Court has 10 same-sex petitions knocking at its doors, all of which are expected to be taken up into consideration tomorrow. The justices are scheduled to privately confer over cases challenging the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA, blocking gay couples from receiving federal marriage benefits, and state bans on gay marriage, presented in this case in the form of California's Proposition 8 and the challenges thereof. The court will have to choose which, if any, of these cases they're going to take up this year. Michael Klarman is the law professor at Harvard. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Could you start with a little bit more of an explanation here of the difference that the court is facing in the issues of DOMA and the Prop 8 cases?
Sure. So the Defense of Marriage Act is a federal statute Congress provided back in 1996 that regardless of whether states decided that they were going to marry same-sex couples, Congress was not going to recognize those marriages for federal law purposes. So, for example, with regard to Social Security survivors benefits or filing joint federal tax returns, doesn't matter whether a same-sex couple is married in Massachusetts, they're not treated as married for federal law. And the question in the DOMA case is, at least in part, does Congress really have a good reason why it's not deferring to state law definitions of marriage, which is the ordinary way Congress would deal with marriage? The issue in the Proposition 8 case is a separate question. It's exclusively a question of individual rights. There is no federalism issue when a state passes a statute. So the question is simply whether it denies equal protection under the 14th Amendment when the state of California says we're going to define marriage so only opposite-sex couples can get married.
What would be the difference in approach or strategy, perhaps, or thinking by the justices to go either or, either DOMA or the Prop 8 cases?
So the general consensus among people who study the Supreme Court and constitutional law seems to be that the Supreme Court's very likely to take one or some combination of the DOMA cases and is a good deal less likely to take the Proposition 8 case, maybe less likely than not, although I don't think it's a remote possibility. It just doesn't seem like a probability. So the reason for this is the DOMA cases, you've got lower courts striking down a federal statute, which is usually one of the criteria that would lead the court to be more likely to grant review. And you also have the U.S. government asking the Supreme Court to take the case, which is another criteria that seems to cut in favor of the court granting review. I also think the DOMA case is a little bit easier on the merits for the Supreme Court because it's easy to imagine a coalition of more liberal justices who sympathize with marriage equality and conservative justices who may or may not support marriage equality, but who believe in federalism and don't think the federal government needs to be defining marriage separately from the states. So I think it's going to be an easier case for the court, and that make the court a little bit more likely to grant review.
I was looking at some of the arguments today, and one thing I saw was that Emily Bazelon, who was writing in Slate, she says that the issue would be better addressed incrementally, the question of gays and their right to marry, that the court should move in small steps and not get out in front of society. She was equating it with the 1967 ruling by the court that overturned the anti-miscegenation laws, which had been challenged and people had raised questions about whether interracial couples could marry 20 years earlier in the 40s, but that if they had moved too soon, they would have maybe found ways to support those laws, enshrine those laws in federal statute. What do you think about that notion?
Well, I agree with the general point that she's making, which is if a Supreme Court gets too far in front of public opinion, there's always a risk that it's going to shoot itself in the foot and generate so much political backlash that it'll actually undermine the decision that it was trying to advance. So there's some examples of that in American history. The classic one might be the death penalty case, where the court in 1972 tried to eliminate capital punishment and actually generated so much support for capital punishment that we've never gotten back to a position in 40 years where we're on the verge of abolition anymore. Some people would say that about Roe versus Wade, the abortion decision in 1973. The court struck down the abortion laws of really 46 states when it said women had a right to abortion all the way to the end of the second trimester of pregnancy for any reason that they chose. And some people, including Justice Ginsburg, have said that may have been moving too fast, too far, and if the court had been more incremental, maybe it wouldn't have generated a potent right-to-life opposition. The trick with same-sex marriage is we're already pretty far along in the development there. 6 or 8 years ago, two-thirds of the country was still opposed. Today, most opinion polls show a majority of Americans in favor. A couple weeks ago, three states became the first states in American history to vote in favor of same-sex marriage. So the country's already pretty far along this route. It's true there are only 9 states that have adopted gay marriage, and I think Emily Bazelon's point is it would be better for the Supreme Court to wait until that was more like 15 or 20 or 25 states. But who knows, right? It's possible if they were to decide this next year, it would produce a political backlash. It's also possible the country's changed so much that there wouldn't be that much resistance. When they struck down bans on interracial marriage in 1967, opinion polls showed that 70% of the country still opposed interracial marriage, and yet today there's a majority in favor of same-sex marriage. So maybe we've actually advanced further on this issue than we had on that issue at the time the court intervened.
You wrote in the New York Times that this is akin to Brown versus Board of Education. How do you compare the two?
Well, I think it's like Brown in the following sense. Most people today would have a hard time imagining that when Brown was decided, it actually divided the country right down the middle. There was a Gallup poll taken that summer after Brown, summer 1954, showing that Americans, by a very slender majority, supported the Supreme Court. Within a decade or two, that slender majority in favor of the decision had become a huge majority, so that today, 98% of Americans would agree that the state shouldn't be in the business of mandating segregation of public schools. I think same-sex marriage is similar in that the underlying trend is so powerful and would be so difficult to counteract that a Supreme Court decision in favor of marriage equality, even though if it were decided today, it would divide the country down the middle in the same way Brown did, within a fairly short period of time, it would be regarded as an iconic decision, and people would look back and say, I can't believe anybody ever disagreed with that. And the reason we know that is because of the trend in popular opinion, which has been so powerful. It's now increasing. Support for gay marriage is now increasing at the rate of 2 or 3 percentage points a year. And there's a pretty sophisticated model that Nate Silver, the guy who does the 538.com column for the New York Times.
He who knows all.
He absolutely. After the election, he knows everything. His model suggests that within 12 years, there will be a majority in every state in the country in favor of same-sex marriage. And even if he's off by a little bit, that's an incredibly formidable showing and would suggest that if the Supreme Court rules in favor, it's not going to be much longer than a decade or two before the decision looks like the Brown versus Board of Education of the gay rights movement.
So what's your thought, Michael Klarman? What are they going to do?
Well, I'm pretty confident they'll grant review in a DOMA case, and I think it's more likely than not they'll strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. I don't think it's more likely than not that they'll grant review in the California case. It was a very narrow lower court decision. I think it's plausible to think that justices will wait a couple years, but I don't know. Nobody knows. We'll find out sometime tomorrow if they want to grant review in the state same-sex marriage case. If they do grant review, I think you get the usual 5-4 division on the court, liberals and conservatives. They disagree on every issue of constitutional law, abortion, affirmative action, the death penalty. They disagree 5-4 on everything. They'll disagree 5-4 on this. And the question is, what will Justice Kennedy do? He's the swing vote on all of this. And you can make out a case that Justice Kennedy might be the fifth vote in favor of same-sex marriage. He wrote the two opinions supporting gay rights in the Supreme Court. He cares about his historical legacy. And as I suggested, on this issue, the handwriting's on the wall, and you could imagine it would be pretty tempting to be the justice who becomes Earl Warren, the justice who wrote Brown versus Board of Education. Justice Kennedy, when he votes with the liberals, is the senior justice, and that means he could write the opinion, which would become the Brown v. Board of the Gay Rights Movement. That might be pretty tempting, but who knows?
Well, Michael Klarman, I appreciate you talking to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Thank you. Michael Klarman is a law professor at Harvard and the author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. You're listening to Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:16. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. Up to one-third of working adults in the U.S. are freelancers. If you're considering joining the ranks of the self-employed, stay tuned for some expert advice coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Aegis Living, a senior living company specializing in assisted living and memory care, fostering social interaction, nutrition, and dedication to resident care. More information by calling 888-222-3202.
We have clouds and rain, 53 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting a high today in the low 50s, clouds and showers the rest of today, tonight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the mid-40s, tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
We're going to talk about whether we really need a grand bargain to avert that fiscal cliff. That's coming up at 10:20. But first, Katie Sewell, did you ever freelance?
I did. I was a freelance writer out of college.
For who? For what?
Mainly for hire. My main client was to write a book interviewing people about their careers so that high schoolers had a map of how to get the career they wanted.
I did a little freelancing. I found it to be the most difficult of jobs.
It was very hard. And hard to collect the money, which we do, which is important. You're going to survive.
It is work. Just having the discipline and finding the jobs, having the discipline. And yet, you talked to this woman, Sarah Horowitz. She told you up to a third of working adults in the U.S. today are freelancers. Is that just the beginning? Is it going to be even more so?
She seems to think so, that it's a new economy, partly spurred by the recession, but it's just going to increase from here.
So for all of us who are freelancers, she's the founder and executive director of the Freelancers Union. She has written the Freelancer's Bible, Everything You Need to Know to Have the Career of Your Dreams on Your Terms. That sounds good.
It does sound good.
All right.
I want that. On my terms.
You have the career of your dreams.
Yeah.
Whether it's on your terms or not is another question.
Right.
But that may be what happens when you have a job. Freelancers have the option always to say, well, I'm just a freelancer. Mm-hmm. But that's a tough road to hoe. What did you talk about?
Well, I started really basic with her. I asked her, where does the term freelance come from?
People think it's from King Arthur's court, but it actually was part of sort of the Victorian era when they too were kind of looking to recreate their past. But really, a freelancer is people who don't work for one employer in the long term, people who do gigs and projects and that sort of thing.
Now, in your book, you say that up to one-third of working adults in the U.S. are now working independently. Is that because of the recession? Did the recession increase the numbers?
Well, you know, I think it's not just the recession, but, you know, it's the changes in technology and globalization and just that this idea that we are going to have a 40-hour work week is essentially over and people are really putting together a bunch of projects and gigs and that's becoming a career.
So why do people choose to go freelance instead of work for a company?
You know, it's funny. If you had asked me that question 10 years ago, I'd say, well, you know, it's a lot of people who are in publishing or media. But, you know, about 3 years ago, I think what started happening was people were saying, you mean I could have a full-time job that's not really secure and have no benefits or not really great benefits? Or I could freelance where I have no job security and not great benefits? And suddenly they were saying, wait a minute, suddenly I have a choice. And freelancing is a way that people are starting to put together not just their work lives, but their lives, because they're thinking very much about the day and what they do in a day and starting to prioritize things that really matter to them. So freelancing is, as it turns out, not just a change in work, but a real change in culture.
Is it an indication that the 9-to-5 working hours are no longer what appeals to people?
Well, you know what's really funny is even if you have some great nostalgia for 9-to-5, there just aren't that many people who even work that way. We're just all working too much in too many ways and not making enough money. We have the worst distribution of income that we've had in over 100 years. And I think what freelancers are starting to say is, you know, wait a minute, I'm going to take that as a given. So then I'm going to look at my life and I'm going to start ending this kind of consumerism in my life because I can't afford it. I'm going to do the things that really matter to me, whether that's being home when my kids are home or walking my dog or singing opera. And I'm going to just put together another life that's more suitable for the economy that we're actually in. And to your question before about the recession, interestingly, a lot of freelancers did better in the recession than traditional workers because they had so many gigs. They were able to be more nimble and versatile, which isn't to say that it was all easy. For sure, it was not. But it's very different.
Well, and the balance, I would expect, is something that needs to be considered, because now if you're working independently, it's possible if you're getting all these gigs, it takes over your life.
For sure. You know, freelancing is the quintessential feast or famine. And really, the most important thing to being a successful freelancer is actually having a robust network. And I don't mean that in the take your business card and put it in somebody's face, but more about having the people that you like and love and want to share with. And what you find is seasoned freelancers have partners who they outsource their work to. So when you end up having too much work, you have somebody who you can partner with. And then on the flip side, during those moments of famine and panic, you have people who you can call to pick up some gigs. And that really is important. And, you know, part of the reason that I wrote the Freelancer's Bible was because I started really hearing these kinds of advice that freelancers were readily giving one another and started to say, if this is the way that people can lead a meaningful, independent life, we have to start setting out what the rules of the road are so people don't have to keep figuring it out.
What do they need to look at? Well, let's
just start by saying some people are just forced into this. They got laid off and they just can't find a job, or they just graduated from college and these are the jobs. But, you know, to put it in a more positive way, you know, what you really want to do is you want to start looking at what your work will look like. And so I've tried to kind of lay it out and say that they're kind of like, it needs to be the way one would look at a stock portfolio. There's a range of work. You want to see, can you land, maybe before you start freelancing, a kind of gig that's a steadier gig, like a blue chip stock? It may not pay tons of money, but that's the one that's your tried and true, and it's going to give you a set amount. And then you start expanding that portfolio and starting to find jobs that will help you figure out how to either get to those blue chips or the ones that help you start to experiment. And I think that's really important. You know, one of the things that when you listen to freelancers, and I have been on a book tour and it's been really interesting. Somebody said last night, as a matter of fact, I used to just call myself a graphic artist. Now I call myself a brand manager. And so you start to think about the thing you do and are there 8 different ways you can describe it? And then you start really building your network and start getting out there and letting people know the kind of work you're able to do. And that's the kind of thing you have to really be prepared for to get started.
How do you get the word out about what you can do?
Well, you know, it really is a high-touch business in some interesting ways, you know. And I think really this network is, it's almost zen in that you pick the people you like and you love, and the people where you just don't have good energy, they're just not going to give you good work anyway. So you get to strangely have a better life as a freelancer. And you literally start by emailing your friends, letting them know. Really, it's important to be part of professional organizations, community organizations. It's really important because you never know where you're going to meet somebody and get work. And so one of the things I tell people when they're in the worst moment of panic about getting a job
strangely, the most important thing is to think, well, what can I give? What can I give? And you know that you can always give. You can work in a homeless shelter. You can volunteer. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, it actually, A, makes you feel better, does something good, but it also surprisingly builds this network up. So really, it's all about actually finding the people that you like and care about and keeping up with them. And isn't that just a better way to live your life anyway, and to actually have time for interconnection of the people you like? And to this may come as a big surprise. Go to lunch with people building your network, and it's tax deductible. So it actually makes a lot of sense.
I'm speaking with Sarah Horowitz. She's the founder and executive director of the Freelancers Union and the CEO of the Freelancers Insurance Company. She's also MacArthur Foundation Genius Fellow and the author of the Freelancers Bible. Are there particular fields that lend themselves well to freelancing?
Well, you know, it really started in the 70s in a big way. Sort of 1973 was the watershed year of like everything, you know, wages declined, unions declined. And publishing, I think, really started this out, if I had to pick an industry. Mm-hmm. But what is so surprising now is it's really across the board, from nannies to programmers to anesthesiologists. And that's what we're seeing is it's gig like, you know, IBM predicts that 50% of their workforce will be working independently. And so what we need to do is start building up places that help people work this way. Not everyone's a marketing genius. Not everyone knows how to figure out their benefits. Not everyone mm-hmm. is going to be able to do everything. And right now, as a freelancer, you really have to be able to.
Well, you think of freelancing as something that you're doing very alone. And you're talking about this network. Is that no longer the case, that it's me in my home office by myself?
Well, if you are sitting in your office in your jammies by the computer and you're all alone all the time, just FYI, that's not good. And so it really is about recreating different ways to have community. There are co-working spaces that you can rent some time during the week, and you can very much start to plan in your day how you are going to go and be active in these different kinds of groups, because really that is the secret. The whole big secret to freelancing is having this network of people to find out information, to share and barter, to get your benefits, to find out, share your skills. Let's say you want to figure out, you know, this part of freelancing is not working for me. I want to try something new. These are just all the ways that people can really work well, and it's a better way to live like that.
You address in one chapter about troubleshooting. You spend a lot of time talking about deadbeat clients, people mm-hmm. who will not pay.
Yes.
How big of a problem is that for freelancers?
Well, you know, at Freelancers Union, when we surveyed our members, 77% said that at one time they had not been paid, and it turns out to be huge. And, you know, just to go over just some quick tips about that, you know, number one, the most important thing is that you get clarity right from the beginning. What's this project? What's the expectation? And then the second that your gut tells you something's not right, well, be proactive about it. Because what happens is that for freelancers, if you don't get paid, your only option is going to small claims court. One of the most important things is having a contract. People can go to the Freelancers Union website, and you can join the Freelancers Union, by the way, for free. But you go to the website, and for free as a contract creator, and it'll help you just set up a contract. If you're feeling like your gut says, that's not right for me, these people will never hire me again if I do this, then send an email and summarize what you're doing. But just make sure that if the company or the employer that you're not working for is being clear that you are. And that's one of your best protections. Another thing at Freelancers Union is we have a place for people to talk about the companies and give raves to the ones that are great and to let other freelancers know the problems. But really, it's important to do that.
Another thing to consider, too, if you're going out on your own is that you have to manage your taxes and your retirement, give yourself a vacation, and also figure out how you're going to pay for certain things when money comes and money goes. So how does a person balance thinking through all that. That's a lot to know about and to learn.
Well, you know, there's just one really simple answer, and I swear I'm completely not related to the accounting field, but you need to get an accountant. So I hate to be so simple, but that's a simple one. But it is really true. You know, there are some really good rules of thumb that people have where they say every dollar comes in, 60 cents goes into your checking account and 40 into your savings to pay for benefits and taxes. It really is important for people to be able to manage their careers. But let's say you're bad at it. Well, there you go. Another good example where somebody else might be really great at it and bad at something else or something they don't want to do. And you start forming these kinds of partnerships. And those are the kinds of things at the Freelancers Union that we're really trying to help people so that they don't have to keep doing it. And at the Freelancers Bible, it gives you all sorts of ideas of how you can deal with these difficult things.
Speaking with Sarah Horowitz, who's the founder and executive director of the Freelancers Union and the author of the new book, The Freelancer's Bible, Everything You Need to Know to Have a Career of Your Dreams on Your Terms. Are there certain personality types that do better working independently than other types?
You know, it's funny. I think it's like almost anything where being resilient is just so important. But I think that people, their fear is, I'm not outgoing. I don't know how to market myself. But really what you find is that it's the people who really think about, how do I explain what I do? How do I educate and tell people what I do and sort of get themselves out of a frame that, you know, I'm good at sales or something like that. A lot of times there's no one quintessential type. People come in all different shapes and sizes. But I think you do, again, really have to connect with others. It's a great irony. When you work on your own, you must be connected to people.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of people who have ended up being independent workers got that way because of the recession. Mm-hmm. Do you act differently if you're a freelancer who ultimately would like to end up back in the workplace? Should you be managing your career differently versus somebody who loves being independent and wants to stay that way?
Well, the reality is that we're just not seeing this return of the full-time job with full benefits. And some people will say, I just can't freelance. I hate it. And so they end up just picking up gigs and continuing to search. And many may very well find a full-time job, and that's great if they do. But if you don't, you then really have to develop these different ways to make sure that you're going to be okay, especially when this looks like the trend. But I would say what we're going to see in the next 5 and 10 and 15 years is that a lot of businesses and unions and other groups are going to come together to start making this much easier. And then I think there are other things that are really important, and that is that people need to really engage in advocacy to start talking about what kind of society we want and how we can set an agenda that will enable freelancers and all workers to do better than they have been doing, for sure.
Yeah, throughout your book, you have advocacy alerts, which are things that need action. Is there one issue in particular you think that freelancers should be paying attention to?
Well, if you don't mind my saying, I'll just pick like two or three, because
okay.
Number one is that freelancers aren't counted. The Bureau of Labor Statistics hasn't counted freelancers since 2005, and we really don't have a handle on what's happening in this workforce. President Obama has this in his budget right now, but, you know, the Department of Labor needs to be the one to get the job done. You know, I'm starting to think if the Department of Labor doesn't do it, let's get somebody else to do it, like Commerce. I don't know. And so freelancers, we need to start coming together. We have a federal PAC and a state PAC, and to start saying, you know, what we contribute to this economy, we really need to start getting measured. The next one is to really start making sure that people get paid on time. You know, some of the largest companies treat freelancers like invoices. And so they're just accounts receivables and get paid at 30 days, 60 days, and 90 days when your rent and mortgage and all those other things come monthly. And if you want to get paid on time, you get paid 96 cents on the dollar. Well, that should just be illegal. It is illegal for employees. And that's something that increasingly we want to start working on. You know, why make it that freelancers who are so contributing to this economy, they actually are the ones with the jobs, we should be making this easier, not harder. And these are the kinds of things that freelancers are really trying to step up and get elected officials and others to start doing this. I have to say, you know, our base is in New York, and New York has become one of the most freelancer-friendly states. And that's why we're going out to other states and starting to build this and finding elected officials who actually care.
Is it important that freelancers unionize?
Yeah. And, you know, unions will have evolved since the beginning of time. You know, there have been craft unions and industrial unions, and freelancers don't work in any one place, so it's not like they can engage in collective bargaining. But the larger point of coming together and solving our problems, and freelancers, our strategy at the Freelancers Union is we bring people together to have power in the markets. Let's just come together and build our own insurance company. And we've already done that and shown just this year, as a matter of fact, that we're having zero premium increases at our insurance company. And in Brooklyn, we just opened a primary care practice that has primary care for free, all you can eat for free with yoga, meditation, acupuncture, etc.
I'm sure people would love to see that in Washington. That's the Freelancers Insurance Company, which you're the CEO of. And Sarah Horowitz is also the founder and executive director of the Freelancers Union and the author of The Freelancers Bible, a new book that tells you everything you need to know to have a career of your dreams on your own terms. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell.
We have a link to Freelancers Union at our website, kuow.org. And from freelancing to inventing, we'll talk about the effect patent trolls may be having on innovation in the United States. That's coming up.
Congress is talking about an immigration overhaul again. Republican Raul Labrador wants to do it gradually.
If we do a comprehensive package, what you're going to have is a bill that every single member of Congress hates a certain aspect of it and no one is going to vote for.
I'm Renee Montagne, changing the immigration laws on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 9:36.
Support for KUOW comes from At a Glance Wallmates, a new line of self-adhesive dry erase planning products for the home and office. More information at ataglance.com.
Hi, this is Ina Jaffe of NPR News. The news and information you rely on every day is made possible by listeners who value public radio for being an independent news source, listeners who value this service and who support it. If you recently received an appeal in the mail, please make your tax-deductible gift before December 31st to help support the programs you'll rely on in the coming new year. Mail in your gift today or make it online at kuow.org. Thank you.
We have clouds and showers, 52 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting a high today in the low 50s. Clouds and rain the rest of today, tonight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the mid-40s, tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
Patents are where the innovator turns dreams into dollars. In the U.S., the patent system has made many a millionaire out of a patent holder with a good idea. But now there are complaints that the risk-reward formula has unfairly shifted. The pejorative term, patent troll, describes a person or a company that makes money by owning or licensing patents but doesn't produce any actual related goods of their own. Instead, they aggressively sue to collect fees from companies that manufacture products, even when they may be only tangentially infringe on patents. A major criticism is that these non-participating entities, as they're more formally described, force companies to pay fees well beyond the scope of their intellectual venture. By the way, the Bellevue-based Intellectual Ventures is considered one of the leading patent trolls. Ironically, their co-founder actually coined the phrase. Now, founder Nathan Myhrvold sees the patents as an asset like any other, that it's never fair for a company to violate any patent, and that people are getting paid for their ideas now where they weren't before, especially in the tech world. Studies out suggest that the cost of litigation undertaken by the so-called patent trolls is putting a multi-billion-dollar chill on American innovation. The FTC has just set up a a workshop December 10th that's going to explore the impacts on innovation and competition from these patent-holding entities. Cheryl Malone has written about these issues in Forbes.com. She's the founder and chief executive of Article One Partners, a venture-funded patent prior art research community. And we'll get to prior art in a minute, Cheryl Malone. Thank you for talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What do you see as examples of patent trolling?
So we have to be careful when we use a pejorative term. Historically, a non-practicing entity as a paradigm for this is Thomas Edison. And so the appropriate monetization of patent assets is within our legal system. The notion of a troll has more to do with the quality of the patent being asserted and the manner in which they're asserted. Let's talk about quality first. The U.S. Patent Office is, in a sense, had a tremendous amount of pressure on quality because of its success. So we had a great increase in the number of patents filed. PTOs had a hard time keeping up. Funds have been siphoned away. That's a political issue. And so as a result, they were not able to expend the capacity and resources to make sure patents that were granted are of a high quality. If we then look at the process issue, we have specific activity by patent owners where they target specific jurisdictions to file cases. They approach the defendants with the mantra not of these are high quality assets and deserve remuneration, but rather the cost of your defense of this case is more than our settlement cost, so just settle. So we've got a quality problem and a process problem, but there are a number of actors out there who have high quality assets and who assert them appropriately, and that's part of our patent system.
When you talk about the high quality actors who are asserting their patents appropriately, you also have big companies like Cisco or Rackspace who say they're being affected by these lawsuits, these efforts to assert patents. So who is distinguishing or what mechanism is distinguishing between the high-quality holders and the people who are, well, less honorable, let's say?
Yeah, so the problem is that it's a difficult sorting analysis, right? It's left to our court system. And I would, as a first instance, propose that that's the first area where there really needs to be a stronger enforcement mechanism. There are laws on the books. Rule 11 is a basis that a defendant can use to say that a complaint was filed inappropriately. Companies are sued without even a product being named. And judges have the ability to have a Rule 11 violation. There are attorney's fees that can be and sanctions against actors who abuse the system. The same problem is much smaller in Europe because there is a loser pay system. If you lose the case, you pay. And from a purely economic framework, which is really what's happening here, there's an ability for a return on investment in these litigations that's fueling a process to try and get that revenue. If you make the economics change based on quality in our current judicial system, stuff on the book today, you can start to make a dent. So what ends up happening is that this area is not addressed. There's a number of good proposals out there. I think what the FTC is doing to look into this is very important. And it does impact worldwide brands. It also impacts increasingly small and medium enterprises. We have small companies that are trying to fuel our economy with new jobs, and they're getting hit consistently with these, you know, the process of trying to garner almost a trolling tax out of the operation of their business. And we see it across the board. It's a real problem in our economy. Glad the FTC is doing something about it. I wish the courts would be much more aggressive. The PTO is under the director, Kapos, has done a terrific job of focusing on patent quality and giving more opportunities in post-grant proceedings to be able to evaluate this. So we're starting to see some correction, but it's a difficult problem, multifaceted, and there needs to be aggressive evaluation of, in a sense, abusers, and there needs to be an economic impact on them.
Now, Cheryl Malone, in your firm, you deal with the question of prior art. What is that, and how does that figure into this topic?
Sure. So it's all part of the whole basis of the patent system. When you file a patent, you're saying you're the first person to have created this innovation. And then the patent office looks at the history of innovation before you're filing and says, well, are you the first person? If something's already been published, then the industry has been educated, and therefore you're not entitled to this monopoly right. On the other hand, if something hasn't already been published, then you are entitled to a patent. That history of publications and activities such as on sale or public use, those are all the rubric of prior art. And so the easiest way of thinking about prior art, in our company, we crowdsource, so we try and make it as direct and simple for our community as possible. It's an earlier dated publication with the same technology description as a patent. And our community crowdsources this patent research. And we do it on a number of bases. The primary one, because of the extent of this NPE problem, is in litigation defense. So we're involved in many of the high-profile patent litigations, assisting the defendants, also, in a sense, the plaintiff, to come to understand the quality of the patents at issue and to support a resolution as quickly and as efficiently as we can for parties. And we tend to work mostly on the defense side. The trolls don't find our platform very appealing because we're trying to get the accurate substantive answer without any manipulation of the process.
Now, the Congress took this up in the last few years, and the America Invents Act came out of it. Last year, a dog's breakfast is what I heard Nathan Myhrvold call it, but he said that overall it was the best compromise that could be achieved. What does it do, and does it get us on the path to supporting the intellectual ownership of a patent and yet at the same time not stifle innovation?
So it's certainly a step in the right direction. A lot of stakeholders in the patent industry, from worldwide brands, from different industries like high tech versus pharma, and also from stakeholders such as individual inventors. Director Pappas' leadership at the Patent Office, I think, has created really a high point in the history of the Patent Office for making practical solutions to try and accomplish a goal. In this case, the goal is to improve patent quality. And by having patents of higher quality come out of the Patent Office, there should be a decrease in the ability to assert patents of questionable quality. So to that extent, I think that the compromise that was worked out for the AIA is a success. It's the best that could be done. What I'm interested in seeing is the PTO's implementation of the AIA. A lot of rules were implemented in September. There'll be more in March. And they give additional proceedings where the parties can put forth prior art to have the quality of the patents better assessed. A postscript, Director Kappas is now stepping down in January, so I hope that the successor will be able to continue the exceptional work that he's been trying to accomplish.
Well, let me ask you this last question. I mean, we have these reports that say that all this effort, and I think the folks at Boston University, when they looked at this study, and they were quoted as saying that the headline is "Patent Trolls Cost U.S. Bodies $29 billion last year," and again, you're talking about what's a pejorative and what's legitimate. Nathan Myhrvold, who is the head of Intellectual Ventures, which on many people's list is the worst patent troll, the most fearsome patent troll, is the way they're quoted. He was quoted as saying, "Look, this is capitalism. It's not worse to make money by investing in patents than it is to buy stocks. They provide billions of dollars to their investors, and that this is the open source system of patenting, and this is how it works, and they're just making sure they're getting value for people who took out patents." So how do you view Intellectual Ventures yourself, personally, being in the industry, and how should we view it, having it in our backyard, in where innovation is king?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't want to speak specifically about any one company. The ability in the monetization of patent assets to leverage a system that has significant problems, or that's our litigation system, to get a return versus getting a return on the asset value, to me, is a system that has some serious problems. And those who look for ROI, no matter who they are, whether they're considered to be, quote, trolls, whether they're an individual inventor who tried to monetize, tried to run a business in our economy, didn't succeed, and therefore are looking to get a return for its investors through the patent asset, or it's a large company who's giving a part of its patent portfolio that it's not executing on to another company to invest. The ability of the holders of those assets to make a decision to approach the industry on the basis of quality assets rather than leveraging a litigation process that I think, you know, it's not just patent, but litigation process has a lot of problems. That to me is what the important focus is. And I think anyone who is a stakeholder in the patent industry should be directed to answer that question. You know, how are you trying to monetize your patent assets? And are you focusing on quality and on bringing value rather than on leveraging a litigation system that's broken? I think that's an important question. And we all have a choice to make, right? I think there's the most telling stat out there, you know, the Boston number, it's quite high. You know, there's a lot of analysis continuing to go on about whether that's the right number. But we see companies like Apple and others listing in their filings that they are spending more money on litigation today than in R&D. That's a real problem. And we see smaller companies being hit by a litigation process that takes money out of their R&D, out of their economic fueling of our economy. That's a real problem. I think focusing on names and specific companies is less the issue than having these companies have to answer on a quality basis and how they're monetizing, what is their process.
Cheryl Malone, I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, yes, my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Cheryl Malone has written about the issues of patents and non-practicing entities and their effect on innovation. Forbes.com. She's part of Article One Partners, which deals with these issues. The FTC is holding a workshop next week to take a look at the impacts of innovation and litigation on the patent system. Intellectual Ventures in our area is one of the biggest holders of many patents and has an effect on innovation, some people say. This is Weekday. And now, let's go to the theater, Marcy Silman.
You ever been to the late group theater?
Yeah, I used to love to go to the group theater.
After group theater died, it was kind of a dispersal of folks who were into multicultural theater. And what we've seen maybe in the last 5 years or so is a rebirth of small projects. Hansberry Project at ACT Theater, focusing on African-American artists and playwrights. And a few years ago, one of the group theater veterans, Rose Cano, decided that she wanted to revive Latino theater, and especially pertinent now because Hispanics are the largest growing population group in Washington State. So she decided to do that, and she gathered together a group of artists, and they formed a company called Ese Teatro, and Ese is about to have its first main stage production as part of ACT Central Heating Lab. So I met with Rose Cano, and I asked her first to just tell me what her theater company was.
Ese Teatro, Seattle Latinos Take Stage, is a Latino theater company. It was founded about 3 years ago. A group of us came together under a collective model, and we slowly have been transitioning into a stable theater, an organization, an institution. Our mission is to promote, present, create, produce theater in English, Spanish, bilingually, and Spanglish.
You mentioned you've been transitioning, and just this year you have transitioned yourself from being a collective member to being the artistic director. What do you envision, then, is the artistic goal, or what kinds of theater do you want specifically your company to produce and present?
Well, above all, I wanted to create a platform for Latino voices, a professional platform for Latino voices here in Seattle, because I felt that was a gulf that was not here in a city of our size. And there are Latino theaters in most cities around the country, in Portland, 3 hours to the south. So one, I wanted to create this professional platform that would attract other Latino artists to our area. That, I think, is the main thing. And the other thing is to be able to provide outreach to different Latino neighborhoods. Our idea is to be protagonists of our own story. So not waiting for the larger mainstream theaters to choose the maybe one play a year or maybe one play every 2 years to talk about some kind of Latino reality. It's to be able to make decisions about what we want to talk about. And that could mean what playwright, which play, in what language, about which culture. So, and it's looking at Latinos and Latino theater is sort of what I call all the colors in the rainbow of brown. There's so many expressions of being Latino in the United States, whether you're immigrant, non-immigrant, first generation, second generation, newly arrived, been here for four generations from South America, Central America.
So you talk about being the protagonists of your own story and producing work that is representative of a huge and very diverse community in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you're letting main stage theaters, the mainstream theaters off the hook, that you don't want them to be including Latino artists in their annual schedules?
You know what I envision is amazing partnerships. I really think that is the future of ethnically specific theaters. I think it's part of a national conversation. And now there is a National Latino Theater Alliance, which was a movement started at the last TCG conference in Boston.
That's Theater Communications Group.
Right, right. The largest and most established theatrical organization. And a lot of the conversations were about, okay, where are we now in terms of ethnically specific theaters and mainstream theaters? So I think, answering your question, no, it's not letting mainstream theaters off the hook. It's putting them on the hook, saying, how can we work together?
Coming up in December, you're going to be presenting your first main stage production, and that's out of a partnership with ACT Theater, part of the Central Heating Lab.
Yeah.
This is the second play that Ese has produced by Luis Alfaro, and I'm going to have you say it in Spanish because I'll just butcher it. It's based on the tragedy Oedipus.
Oedipus el Rey by Luis Alfaro. Luis Alfaro MacArthur, genius award winner and very innovative playwright. And one of the things he does many things, is do these Chicano takes on Greek tragedies. So this is a Chicano take on Oedipus the King, you know, a 2,000-year-old Greek tragedy, mm-hmm. or 3,000-year-old, I'm not even sure.
Old,
transported into the L.A. prison system. And I mean, the California prison system and L.A. and gang culture. And it fits perfectly, actually.
The performance is not necessarily aimed specifically at Spanish-speaking audiences, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. And this play is, I would say, 85%, 90% in English, and peppered with Spanish and Spanglish. But it's the culture that it represents. And obviously, it is this Greek tragedy. And so we can see the comparison with this gang warfare, and these tragedies of epic proportion are really everyday events, even now.
You do all of this outside of your day job. You have a full-time job. You have a unique perspective. I'm just thinking sort of about the social context of making art.
I think part of my vision of art and society comes from the 10 years when I went back to live in Peru, where I was born. And it was a very active time. There's a lot of political struggle. And the role of the artist in society was so prevalent, at least that's what I saw as a young person, was so prevalent in reflecting the day-to-day major changes in political landscape. It was things that affected you every day. It was about, you know, having electricity or not that day. I mean, there was just so many things going on in the fabric of the country that artists were used to reflecting. So when I moved back to Seattle, I was feeling that theater is in a way too separate from these everyday realities. And so when I began to be a medical interpreter, I've been a Spanish medical interpreter for about 18 years now. I used to think I had like two split lives, the healthcare industry and then the arts. And now, as I was telling a friend the other day, I can't keep the two worlds separate now. They're always overlapping because there's always a message and a story to be told. As an interpreter,
That's my job, to render the story or what has happened from one language to the other, English to Spanish, Spanish to English. So in that interpreting, in that rendering, you're hearing thousands of stories. So that's fed me as a playwright. I think the lowest common denominator for everybody is that everybody at some point gets sick and everyone goes through the healthcare system. So it just gives you just food for stage. That's how I see it.
You know, there is this sense that at least traditionally art has been something separate. So when you have gone out into the mm-hmm. communities with your plays, your workshops, mm-hmm. or brought people to act, say, to see what you're doing, what kind of feedback do you get from people who maybe don't enter those four walls?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the point, to bring theater to the community and the community to the theater. So through a project called Empowering the Homeless Through Theater, we invited people to the Multicultural Playwrights Festival at ACT to see the reading we did of a play I wrote, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, Homeless in Seattle. And so during intermission, one of these gentlemen came up to me, said, "Gracias. No pensé que nos iban a tener en cuenta." And that means thank you. I didn't think anyone would ever take us into account.
Rose Cano, actor and artistic director of SA Teatro, Seattle's newest bilingual theater company. SA Teatro's first main stage production, Oedipus El Rey, opens December 5th at ACT Theater, part of ACT's Central Heating Lab. She talked to Marcy Silman. The Sound and much more next hour on Weekday.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.